Howdy, everyone, and thank you again for tuning in to the Jeffersonian Tradition. Before we get started, I have a couple of things to go over. I want to keep bringing y'all high-quality content, but I cannot do that without your support. So please, help buy me a cup of coffee every month and join the Ward Republic by chipping in $5 per month through the supporting listener link in the show notes page. I am not part of a fancy podcasting network, and I don't like the restrictions that come along with certain advertising campaigns, so I am coming to y'all with my hat in my hand. So please help me keep this show going and keep it independent by doing your part and chipping in. If you're not comfortable with a recurring contribution model, I do also have a Cash App profile for the show, so one-time contributions can be sent there, and all of this information is listed in the show notes page as well. And don't forget that Ward Republic membership includes a monthly video conference with myself and the other Ward Republic members. And support monetary freedom today and head over to our sponsor at www.defythegrid.com to purchase your gold bags. I have an affiliate link in the show notes page, and if you use it, I will get a 1% commission, so that'll also help keep the show going. So click on my link in that show notes page and fuel monetary decentralization today. And if you aren't on MeWe yet, then seriously, what are you waiting for? Unlike a certain other social media platform, MeWe respects the right to free speech and offers a privacy bill of rights. So if you'd like to be a member there, then download the MeWe app and search for me at the username Mr. Jeffersonian. The show group is private, so we must be contacts before I can send you the group invite. With all of that fun stuff out of the way, let's now turn our attention to the topic for today's episode.
Hello, fellow citizens. Today we continue our study of some Richard Weaver essays that I find to be extremely relevant in today's time. And we're going to study specifically his essay from his book In Defense of Tradition, or a compilation book of his, In Defense of Tradition. And the title of the essay is Conservatism and Libertarianism, the Common Ground. I mentioned this essay in the last couple of episodes we did, and I did want to go ahead and get this one out. And what we're going to do today is kind of juxtapose what Weaver is saying as far as where do conservatives and libertarians overlap with something that Lysander Spooner said, and why I think to some extent Weaver was wrong on this particular essay. Now, it's still a good essay, and it's still definitely worth reading. And he does say some things that, yes, libertarians and conservatives could definitely be allies. But I think he was maybe a little bit overly optimistic. But I do have to also remember the context of his time as he wrote this essay, or it was published in 1960. So he's writing at the height of the Cold War, and the right is in a state, or the American right, rather, is in a state of total flux and chaos. They're trying to cast about and find what their identity is going to be to combat this. You have the neoconservatives led by people like James Burnham, who want the United States to beat the Soviet Union by becoming the Soviet Union, or like the Soviet Union. And then you have people like Richard Weaver, Murray Rothbard, Frank Meyer, so on and so forth, who say, no, the way that we beat this is actually to double down and rededicate ourselves to the principle of our founding, which is decentralization and ultimate freedom, or maximum freedom. So this is going to be a really interesting essay. Now, before we start, I do just want to reiterate that we are approaching the end of the year, and please, if you're looking for anywhere to dump a little bit of extra cash, I would greatly appreciate that. Again, I do want to let y'all know I am not set up as any sort of nonprofit organization. I'm doing this strictly as an individual, so you won't get any sort of tax benefit for contributing money to the show or to my efforts here, but I would greatly appreciate it, and it would help us out tremendously with our diaper fund. So with all that being said, though, let's go ahead and get started. We're going to open with Weaver's essay, and then we're going to have pauses throughout so I can offer commentary and then insert some excerpts from Lysander Spooner. And Weaver opens the essay. The subject of this paper is the common ground between conservatism and libertarianism. Not the possible common ground, for I am convinced that they already, or naturally, share the same place on the political arc, even though sometimes they are found eyeing one another rather uneasily. Among the theorists in both groups, it is true, we sometimes sense an unwillingness to come into a common front, apparently out of a feeling that this would require some fatal concessions. I hope to show that this is not so. It can be demonstrated that while the positions of the conservative and that of the libertarian may not overlap exactly, they do have an overlapping, and they certainly are not in necessary conflict. Okay, so in this opening paragraph, I just wanted to pause here and give a little bit of context about how I came to libertarianism originally. So growing up, I was part of a Southern, kind of a Reagan Republican type household. Now, my mom and dad always did have veneration for the South, and my dad especially really taught me, hey, the war was about states' rights, and the North was trying to overtake the South numerically, and that just wasn't okay. So the South seceded, and they fought for their rights as they perceived them to be. So when I came to libertarianism, my dad had also taught me that conservatism was mostly about limiting the reach and scope of government. So when I came to libertarianism, it was like, hey, I'm already exposed to this line of reasoning, like the government which governs best governs least. And libertarianism to me just kind of seemed to be the rational next step. So yes, I took that step, and then I kind of went down the rabbit hole for several years. And so to this point, I can agree with Richard Weaver. I fully agree with him that there are some strong overlaps between conservatives and libertarians, depending on where you approach libertarianism from. If you are somebody who says the primary means of libertarianism or the primary goal of libertarianism should be to limit the reach of the state, it makes all the sense in the world. But if you are somebody who approaches libertarianism from the left, there's a strong tendency to say, well, no, we shouldn't necessarily limit the reach of the state. What we should do is use the state as an enforcer of so-called civil rights. And that can be incredibly dangerous. And there are some libertarians, even of the anarcho-capitalist variety now, who are starting to kind of fall under the sway of that line of reasoning. As I've mentioned before on the show, when we talk about the New York rifle and pistol case, a lot of libertarians thought that was a wonderful decision because it used the government to reinforce civil rights, and they made an appeal to the federal constitution to do so. So there's a fundamental difference there, in my opinion, if you approach it from the right or from the left. If you say the government which governs best governs least, yes, libertarianism is a natural conservative ally. But if instead you say, well, no, the government which governs best acts as an enforcer of the trendy civil right of the day, that's incredibly dangerous, because look what's going on now with everything in the culture war that's being shoved down our throats. That's exactly what the government is doing. It's acting as an enforcer of a social agenda or ideology. So it definitely matters from where do you approach it. But to the extent and in the context that Weaver's talking about this, I do agree with him. There should be a lot of natural overlap between conservatives and libertarians. But let's go ahead and continue and see what else Weaver has to say. The modifier which has been most frequently applied to my own writings is conservative. I have not exactly courted this, but I certainly have not resented it. And if I had to make a choice among the various appellations that are available, this is very likely the one that I would wind up with. I must say that I do not see any harm in it, and in this I am unlike some of my friends, unlike some people with whom I agree on principles, but who appear to think that the term is loaded with unfavorable meanings, or at least connotations. And there is, in fact, a concept of conservatism filled with disparagement, which needs to be fought by everyone who believes that a conservative philosophy is useful and constructive. There are some people who appear to think that conservatism means simply lack of imagination. The conservative, unable to visualize anything else, just wants to sit down with the status quo. There are others who seem to think that conservatism means timidity. The conservative is a person who has a sneaking presentiment that things might be better, but he is simply afraid to take the risk of improvement. There are some who seem to think that conservatism is a product of temperamental slowness. If your mind or reflexes don't work as fast as other people's, then you must be a conservative. In these conceptions, the conservative is always found behind, whether from mental or physical deficiency, or just plain fearfulness. Naturally, nobody looks to that kind of person for leadership. But this is very far from my image of the conservative. A conservative, in my view, is a man who may be behind the times, or up with the times, or ahead of the times. It all depends on how you define the times. And this brings us at once to the matter of an essential definition. It is my contention that a conservative is a realist who believes that there is a structure of reality independent of his own will and desire. He believes that there is a creation which was here before him, which exists now not by just his sufferance, and which will be here after he's gone. This structure consists not merely of the great physical world, but also of many laws, principles, and regulations which control human behavior. Though this reality is independent of the individual, it is not hostile to him. It is, in fact, amenable by him in many ways, but it cannot be changed radically and arbitrarily. This is the cardinal point. The conservative holds that man in this world cannot make his will his law without any regard to limits and to the fixed nature of things. And here, I absolutely love Weaver's definition of what a conservative is, especially how he ties it in with the conservative may be behind the times or ahead of the times. It all depends on how you define the times. I love that passage. And I also love that he points out that conservatives understand, value, and realize that there is a creation, as Weaver says, which was here before him, which exists now not by just his sufferance, and which will be here after he's gone. So we need to conserve things, and we need to understand that it's imperative we understand these things, we conserve them, and we pass them on to the next generation. Because Weaver, in this book, the whole concept of the defense of tradition is we come from over 2,000 years of Anglican, kind of a European Anglican tradition of human experience. We've won many of these rights through very hard-fought battles. We've come through many dark periods. You know, you have the Dark Ages, which weren't actually as dark as most people make them out to be, but you have the Dark Ages, you have the collapse of the Roman Empire, and then you have the struggle of the kind of Anglo-British people coming up and figuring out these things through trial and error, many, many years of trial and error. And so we need to understand it's important. These things predate us, and they're going to be here after we're gone as well. We need to preserve them. If we can improve them, great, but any improvements we make need to be within the context of reason or within the bounds of reason. We don't need to change things or scrap things just because. We need to understand the value of what we have, improve it where we can, and pass it on to the next generation. And that's where we're going to tie in some Lysander Spooner, but that's going to be a little bit later in the essay, so let's go ahead and continue. There is, in Elizabethan literature, a famous poem titled A Mirror for Magistrates. It contains stories of a large number of rulers, kings, princes, and others who got into trouble and came to untimely and tragic ends. The story from these that I remember with special vividness concludes with this observation as a moral, and it is a kind of refrain line throughout the account. Quote, he made his will his law, end quote. And that has stayed with me as a kind of description of the radical. He makes his will the law instead of following the rules of justice and prudence. Fancying that his dream or wish can be substituted for the great world of reality, he gets into a fix from which some good conservative has to rescue him. The conservative I therefore see as standing on terra firma of antecedent reality, having accepted some things as given, lasting and good. He is in a position to use his effort where effort will produce solid results. Radicals and liberals sometimes try to knock the conservative off balance by asking, what do you want to conserve anyhow? I regard this question as by now substantially answered. The conservative wants to conserve the great structural reality which has been given us and which is on the whole beneficent. And just to add to Weaver's phrase here, John C. Calhoun would also say that to be specifically an American conservative meant that you were conserving states' rights and the right to self-government at your local level. So the liberty of the community to regulate itself, basically, if we want to look at it from kind of a liberty orientation. But that's the problem now, is conservatives have no idea in the main what they want to conserve. Libertarians want to scrap everything and just kind of start over, collapse it all, and then rise from the ashes, whereas conservatives have no idea what they want to conserve anymore. Many of them, they're FDR conservatives, and that's not really a thing. You know, I say that kind of sardonically. FDR was a huge pivot away from any semblance we had remaining of the original republic. Now, obviously, the original republic died in 1865, but when you get FDR and the fusion of government and corporation and the government just overreaching everything and kind of being this huge paternalistic entity, you completely scrap any semblance that we had left of it. Any sort of element of it that was on life support is dead at that point. But a lot of conservatives now, they want to conserve FDR's America. They want to conserve the New Deal. They want to conserve all of that. Social Security being a huge example, Medicaid, the Great Society. Those are things that conservatives want to conserve now, and those are not conservative elements at all. At all. But let's go ahead and get back to the essay. I might make this a little more precise by saying he wants to respect it, although, of course, respect must carry with it the idea of conserving. There is a famous saying of Francis Bacon, which can be applied with meaning here. Bacon does not seem the most likely figure to be brought into a defense of conservatism, but then every great thinker will say some things of general truth. Bacon declared that man learns to command nature by obeying her. The same holds for the moral, social, and political worlds. One does not command these by simply trying to kick them over. One commands them as far as it is possible to do so, or appropriate to do so, by obeying them, by taking due note of their laws and regulations, and by following these and then proceeding to further ends. Of course, the conservative does not accept everything that is as both right and unchangeable. That is contrary to the very law of life. But the changes that he makes are regardful of the forms that antedate, overarch, and include him. The progress that he makes, therefore, is not something that will be undone as soon as his back is turned. The attitude of the radical toward the real order is contemptuous, not to say contumacious. It is a very pervasive idea in radical thinking that nothing can be superior to man. This accounts, of course, for his usual indifference or hostility toward religion, and it accounts also for his impatience with existing human institutions. His attitude is that anything man wants, he both can and shall have, and impediments in the way are regarded as either accidents or affronts. This is very easy to show from the language he habitually uses. He is a great scorner of the past and is always living in or for the future. Now, since the future can never be anything more than one subjective projection, and since he affirmed that he believes only in the future, we are quite justified in saying that the radical lives in a world of fancy. Whatever of the present does not accord with his notions as he classifies as belonging to the past, and this will be done away with as soon as he and his party can get around to it. Whereas the conservative takes his lesson from a past that has objectified itself, the radical takes his from cues out of a future that is really the product of wishful thinking. As a general rule, I am opposed to psychoanalyzing the opposition, knowing that this is a game both sides can play. But here we have a case so palpable that one is tempted to make an exception. So many of these radicals seem to be persons of disordered personality. There is something suspicious about this impassioned altruism. They often seem to be struggling to cover up some deep inner lack by trying to reform the habits or institutions of people thousands of miles away. Something like this becomes thus an obsession, almost to the point, or maybe to the point, of irrationality. Not that I regard all desire to reform the world as a sign of being crazy. Even more than that, I would go along with Plato and say that some forms of craziness may be divinely inspired. But here we come to an essential distinction and a parting of the ways. There is a difference between trying to reform your fellow beings by the normal processes of logical demonstration, appeal, and moral suasion. There is a difference between that and passing over to the use of force or constraint. The former is something all of us engage in every day. The latter is what makes the modern radical dangerous and perhaps, in a sense, demented. His first thought now is to get control of the state to make all men equal, or to make all men rich, or failing that, to make all men equally unhappy. This use of political instrumentality to coerce people to conform with his dream in the face of their belief in a real order is our reason, I think, for objecting to the radical. As an individual, he may think about molding the world to his heart's desire. He may even publish the results of his thinking. But when he tries to use the instrumentality of the state to bring about his wishes, then all of us are involved, and we have to take our stand. Here, as I see it, is where conservatives and libertarians can stand on common ground. The libertarian, if my impression is correct, is a person who is interested chiefly in freedom from. He is interested in setting sharp bounds to the authority of the state or other political forms over the individual. The right of the individual to an inviolable area of freedom as large as possible is thus his main concern. Libertarianism, defined in this way, is not as broad a philosophy as I conceive conservatism to be. It is narrower in purview, and it is essentially negative, but this negative aspect is its very virtue. Okay, and so here is kind of where my first divergence with Weaver comes in. Now, granted, I don't really know what the libertarians of his day were like outside of people like Murray Rothbard. You had already had Ludwig von Mises at that point. I think Mises may have already died, but then you have Milton Friedman, F.A. Hayek, so on and so forth. So outside of kind of the big names in libertarianism, I don't know what the underpinnings were. I don't know what the underbelly of libertarianism was like back then. But I can tell you in modern times, there's been a huge fight over kind of what the heart and soul of libertarianism is. And you have the Mises Caucus, which recently took the party over. And to Michael Heiss's credit, I think he's doing good work there. I heard a recent interview with him on Tom Wood's show where he's kind of rooting for Jeffersonian means to build a groundswell coalition and do things from the bottom up instead of the old line approach of taking a top-down aspect on things or look at things. So good job, Michael Heiss. And again, I said several months ago that I thought the Mises Caucus was the best path forward. And now that they have control of the party, I think that still holds true. And why this matters so much to me, if y'all are wondering why do I spend so much time talking about libertarians, it's because I do think America would benefit immensely from a viable third party. And as of right now, I do think libertarians still have the best shot of that, although it's still an incredibly long shot, don't get me wrong. They get less than 5% of the vote, so it's not anything that's going to happen probably in the foreseeable future. But I do think libertarians have the best chance if they can get their messaging right and if it can decide within its purview what is the Libertarian Party going to be, what is the message of libertarianism going to be. So this is where Weaver, in my opinion, is kind of off the mark, at least based on what I can perceive around me in modern times, because he says that conservatives and libertarians can stand on common ground, and that common ground is, again, curtailing the power of the state, whereas a lot of modern libertarians, at least before the Mises takeover, and even now after the Mises takeover, they have turned much more towards the leftist side of that, where they say, well, no, yeah, we want to pay less in taxes, but our primary goal is we want to use the government as an enforcer of rights. And that, again, is very, very dangerous because that opens the door to things like William H. Seward's higher law speech, where it says, you know, basically, it doesn't matter what the Constitution says, moral laws and moral obligations tell me I should be doing this, so I'm going to use my power to do that. And when you apply that to the government, that's very dangerous. If you let it take one step beyond its prescribed powers, as Jefferson said, you're opening it up to a boundless field of power. So again, this is kind of like my first divergence with Weaver, but I do understand the context of he was writing this in a much different time period. So I'm speaking strictly from a modernist standpoint. And typically I would argue against doing that, but just because this is an issue that's still ongoing, I think there is some relevance there because libertarianism today I don't think is what it was in Richard Weaver's day. So just keep that in mind, though, as we move forward. We are getting close to where we're going to have some inserts from Lysander Spooner. But let's go ahead and move forward here with Weaver, and then we'll get to that momentarily. It took the study of John Calhoun to wake me up to a realization that a constitution is and should be primarily a negative document. A constitution, and we may think primarily of the Constitution of the United States in this connection, is more to be revered for what it prohibits than for what it authorizes. A constitution is a series of thou shalt nots to the government, specifying the ways in which the liberties of individuals and of groups are not to be invaded. A constitution is a protection against that kind of arbitrary interference to which government left to itself is prone. It is right, therefore, to refer to our Constitution as a charter of liberties through its negative provisions, and it is no accident that in our day the Friends of Liberty have been pleaders for constitutional government. I think conservatives and libertarians stand together in being this kind of constitutionalist. Both want a settled code of freedom for the individual. Okay, and this is the biggest break, in my opinion, from maybe libertarians in Weaver's day versus libertarians now. Libertarians now have moved in a much, much more radical natural rights direction where they say, well, you know what, ultimately it does not necessarily matter what the Constitution says. What matters is this a natural right? And if so, then government of any level has no authority to interfere with this. And to demonstrate this, I'm going to read to y'all some excerpts from Lysander Spooner's work, No Treason, The Constitution of No Authority, which is kind of like standard recommended reading for a lot of modern libertarians, where they basically say, you know, scrap the Constitution, it doesn't matter. So Spooner wrote this in the aftermath of the War for Southern Independence, and he actually sort of wrote this as a vindication for Southern secession. Now, Spooner hated the South, just so y'all have some context. He hated the South because he hated slavery, and he thought that the slaves should have an uprising. Spooner also funded the John Brown mission to Harper's Ferry. I think he also maybe funded him a little bit in the Kansas ordeal. So Spooner did not like the South, but Spooner despised the Northern response to what the South did when it seceded. Spooner did not believe that the North had a right to invade the South to coerce them to stay. Spooner said, look, if the slaves want their freedom, it's up to them to rise up themselves and rebel. So in this essay, and it's kind of an extended essay, it's not too terribly long, and we're definitely going to trim it, but I just want to give y'all some context on what a lot of modern libertarians think, because Weaver is saying, look, to the extent that we have common ground, it's by clinging to decentralization and the Constitution, whereas Spooner's going to say, not so much. So Spooner says here, the Constitution says, quote, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America, end quote. So he opens this up with the preamble. And then he has this to say about that. He says, the meaning of this is simply, we the people of the United States, acting freely and voluntarily as individuals, consent and agree that we will cooperate with each other in sustaining such a government as is provided for in this Constitution. And there's an immediate issue there, because that is not what the meaning of the preamble is. The meaning of the preamble is not important in the sense of we the people. It's we the people of the United States. The states acting in their corporate or political capacities as states. Spooner is off the mark there right off the bat, and he's saying, look, we only agree and consent insofar as we want to, acting as an aggregated mass. And he goes on to say, the necessity for the consent of the people is implied in this declaration. The whole authority of the Constitution rests upon it. If they did not consent, it was of no validity. Of course, it had no validity except as between those who actually consented. No one's consent could be presumed against him without his actual consent being given, any more than in the case of any other contract to pay money or render service. And to make it binding upon anyone, his signature or other positive evidence of consent was as necessary as in the case of any other contract. If the instrument meant to say that any of the people of the United States would be bound by it who did not consent, it was a usurpation and a lie. So Spooner being highly critical of the Constitution, he's saying, look, none of us living now consented to this because none of us were there to sign it. None of us got a direct vote on it. How could we consent? And that's the direction a lot of modern libertarians have gone. They kind of have this idea that, hey, the Constitution doesn't matter. It's not a binding document on me because I didn't personally sign it. And then Spooner also goes on to say, the number who actually consented to the Constitution of the United States at the first was very small. And he's specifically referencing the literal signers, like the people who actually attended the convention and wrote their name on the document or signed their name to the document. That's who he's referencing as only the people who consented. And he says, considered as the act of the whole people, the adoption of the Constitution was the merest farce and imposture binding upon nobody. The women, children, and blacks, of course, were not asked to give their consent. In addition to this, there were in nearly or quite all the states property qualifications that excluded probably one-half, two-thirds, or perhaps even three-fourths of the white male adults from the right of suffrage. And of those who were allowed that right, we know not how many exercised it. Furthermore, those who originally agreed to the Constitution could thereby bind nobody that should come after them. They could contract for nobody but themselves. They had no more natural right or power to make political contracts binding upon succeeding generations than they had to make marriage or business contracts binding upon them. There is no escape from these conclusions if we say that the adoption of the Constitution was the act of the people as individuals and not of the states as states. So he's acknowledging here, hey, there's different interpretations. So he's saying if we want to go with the nationalist interpretation, which states that the American people ratified this thing at large, as an aggregated mass, then this is the only way to look at it. But he does say if we look at it as the states ratifying it as states, maybe there's some wiggle room. On the other hand, if we say that the adoption was the act of the states as states, it necessarily follows that they had the right to secede at pleasure inasmuch as they engaged for no specific time. So there, Spooner is acknowledging, hey, you know, we have some people who say the article said that the union was perpetual, so that means you can never get out once you get in. But Spooner acknowledges, no, perpetual just means it didn't have to be periodically re-ratified and that the states were not bound for a specific time within the contract. But Spooner is going to, he's going to kind of go in a different direction here. So he continues, it is perhaps unnecessary to say that the principles of this argument are as applicable to the state governments as to the national one. So he's saying, look, even though the states have the right to secede from the federal union, individual citizens have the right to secede from their states. And I disagree with that. I think Weaver would also disagree with that. But I strongly disagree with that because, as Weaver said in Two Types of American Individualism, you didn't have to ask for this. You didn't have to sign anything. It was yours by birthright. All of this that we have gained through many, many years of lived experience is yours by birthright. It is a blessing unto you. And so Spooner is going in a much different direction here because he goes on to say this, the opinions of the South on the subjects of allegiance and treason have been equally erroneous with those of the North. The only difference between them has been that the South has held that a man was primarily under involuntary allegiance to the state government, while the North held that he was primarily under a similar allegiance to the United States government, whereas in truth, he was under no involuntary allegiance to either. And all of this can be summed up in the opening paragraph of No Treason Number 6, in which if you get the compiled book or the compendium book version of this, this would be Chapter 3. But in No Treason Number 6, Spooner writes, quote, the Constitution has no inherent authority or obligation. It has no authority or obligation at all unless as a contract between man and man. And it does not so much as even purport to be a contract between persons now existing. It purports at most to be only a contract between persons living 80 years ago, and it can be supposed that to have been a contract then only between persons who had already come to years of discretion so as to be competent to make reasonable and obligatory contracts. Furthermore, we know historically that only a small portion even of the people then existing were consulted on the subject or asked or permitted to express either their consent or dissent in any formal manner. Those persons, if any, who did give their consent formally are all dead now. Most of them have been dead 40, 50, 60, or 70 years. And the Constitution, so far as it was their contract, died with them. They had no natural power or right to make it obligatory upon their children. It is not only plainly impossible in the nature of things that they could bind their posterity, but they did not even attempt to bind them. That is to say, the instrument does not purport to be an agreement between anybody but the people then existing, nor does it either expressly or impliedly assert any right, power, or disposition on their part to bind anybody but themselves. End quote. So that's kind of the direction libertarianism has gone in. Again, think about what Weaver said. Weaver said he thinks conservatives and libertarians are the staunchest constitutionalists. In his day, that may have been the case, but in modern times, libertarians have gone much more in this Spoonerite direction where they take a couple of lines from Spooner, kind of bastardize it, and say, well, look, the Constitution has no inherent authority. Spooner said so, and they stop right there. They don't think about how did Spooner get there? Where does Spooner go from there? They take a couple of lines from Spooner, much like they do with voting, and say, well, look, the Constitution has no authority. It's either enable what we have now or been powerless to prevent it. That's something else Spooner says a little bit later on in No Treason, but that's where libertarians are at this point in time. They say, we have no validity here. We didn't sign this contract. We didn't ask to be part of this. That's it. And again, Weaver is saying, well, no, to the extent that we can be allies, it has to be on the grounds of decentralization and constitutionalism. So let's go ahead and continue to see what else Weaver has to say. Again, I have a lot of respect for Weaver, and I understand he's writing this 60 years ago, or actually more than 60 years ago. So I don't know exactly how things were in his day. I'm giving this essay as an example of kind of a modern comparison or contrast. So, but let's go ahead and continue to see what Weaver has to say. We're almost done here. This is a fairly short essay in comparison with the ones we've studied recently, but let's get back to it. This is a shared political position, but we can now show that their agreement has a philosophical basis. Both of them believe that there is an order of things which will largely take care of itself if you leave it alone. There are operating laws in nature and in human nature which are best not interfered with or not interfered with very much. If you try to change or suspend them by government fiat, the cost is greater than the return. The disorganization is expensive, the ensuing frustration painful. These laws are part of what I earlier referred to as the structure of reality. Just as there are certain conditions of efficiency for operations in the physical world, so there are conditions for efficient operation in the social and economic worlds. There is a concept expressed by some economists today in the word praxeology. Praxeology, briefly defined, is the science of how things work because of their essential natures. We find this out not by consulting our wishes, but by observing them. For example, I believe it is a praxeological law that a seller will always try to get as much as he can for what he has to sell, and a buyer will always try to pay as little as he can to get it. That is a law so universal that we think of it as part of the order of things. Not only is this law a reliable index of human behavior, it also makes possible the free market economy with its extremely important contribution to political freedom. The conservative and the libertarian agree that it is not only presumption, it is folly to try to interfere with the workings of a praxeology. One makes use of it, yes, in the same way that a follower of Bacon makes use of nature by obeying her. The great difference is that one is recognizing the objective, one is recognizing the laws that regulate man's affairs. Since the conservative and libertarian believe that these cannot be wished away through the establishment of a utopia, they are both conservators of the real world. And this is another point where I tend to disagree with Weaver, at least based on modern libertarianism, because now many of them have moved to a direction of, we want to end Capistan. If that means we cheer on a total collapse so we can rise from the ashes, it doesn't matter how we get there, but that's what we want. And I don't know how serious they are about that. And I've posed this question to a couple of them that I've interacted with, and they haven't really answered it. But, I've asked the question, if there was a button that you could push right now to bring on the collapse and get to end Capistan tomorrow, would you push it? I can tell you I wouldn't. And I didn't really start thinking about that until we went through the insanity of the pandemic in the last 2+ years. And when I started thinking about it, people now, many of them, don't want unlimited freedom. They don't want that. So we have to work within the confines of what we have, which is, hey, if we can at least kind of bring that power back to our local level and get people used to thinking about that instead of thinking about DC, that would be a much better approach. And we can kind of slowly start to wean people back in a direction where they can think for themselves, where they can handle themselves. But libertarians, a lot of them, at least the radical ones, they still say, nope, give us Capistan or give us nothing. And I just don't think that's a winning strategy. But let's go ahead and get back to it. My instincts are libertarian, and I am sure that I would never have joined effort with the conservatives if I had not been convinced that they are the defenders of freedom today. This fact is so evident in the contemporary world that one hardly needs to point out examples of it. It requires only a little experience in politics or publishing for one to learn that the enemies of freedom today are the radicals and the militant liberals. Not only do they propose through their reforms to reconstruct and regiment us, they also propose to keep us from hearing the other side. Anyone who has contended with Marxists and their first cousins, the totalitarian liberals, knows that they have no intention of giving the conservative alternative a chance to compete with their doctrines for popular acceptance. If by some accident they are compelled physically to listen, it is with indifference or a contempt because they really consider the matter a closed question that is no longer on the agenda of discussable things. The conservative, on the other hand, is tolerant because he has something to tolerate from, because he has, in a sense, squared himself with the structure of reality. Since his position does not depend upon fiat and wishfulness, he does not have to be nervously defensive about it. A new idea or an opposing idea is not going to topple his position. He is accordingly a much fairer man and I think a much more humane man than his opposite, whom I have been characterizing. He doesn't feel that terrible need to exterminate the enemy which seems to inflame so many radicals of both the past and the present. This can be shown by relating an incident from the career of George Washington, who figures in my mind as the archetypal American conservative, a man versed in the ways of the world but uncorrupted by them, a man whose unshakable realism saved our infant republic. Washington, for example, had the very ticklish job of maintaining relations with radical revolutionary France during both of his administrations. In 1793, there arrived in this country one Citizen Genet, new minister from the French Republic, whose commission it really was to stir up trouble. He tried to involve the United States in a new war with Great Britain, and he even threatened to appeal to the American people over the head of their government. He was the sharpest thorn in Washington's side for some while. But the next year, 1794, came the fall of Genet's party, the Girondins, and the accession to power of Robespierre and his radical Jacobin government. Genet was replaced, and Washington was requested to send him back to France, where he undoubtedly would have faced the guillotine. But, and I here quote the words of a recent biographer, quote, "Washington would take no agency, even remote, in the bloody business of the French terror. Whatever Genet had done or tried to do, the president did not intend to order the young man to his doom. If Genet wished, it was agreed he might have political asylum in America," end quote. So Genet became an American citizen and lived peacefully for 40 years in our conservative republic. This impresses me as a classical instance of conservative tolerance and essential humaneness. But thinking back to this period may remind us that Washington was himself a revolutionist, and this to my mind refutes any notion that a conservative must be distinguished by timidity and apathy. When the time is out of joint, he can be an active exponent of change. The difference is that he does not have the inflamed zeal of his counterpart, the radical revolutionist, who thinks that he must cut off the heads of his opponents because he cannot be objective about his own frustrations. It is interesting to know, in taking leave of this subject, that Washington's farewell address was noticed by the London Times. What it had to say was this, quote, "General Washington's address is the most complete comment upon English clubs and clubbists, upon factions and parties and factious partisans. The authority of this revolutionist may be set up against the wild and wicked revolutionist of Europe, if not as an altar against an altar, at least as an altar against sacrilege," end quote. In conclusion, I maintain that the conservative in his proper character and role is a defender of liberty. He is such because he takes his stand on the real order of things and because he has a very modest estimate of man's ability to change that order through the coercive power of the state. He is prepared to tolerate diversity of life and opinion because he knows that not all things are of his making, and that it is right within reason to let each follow the law of his own being. A rigid equalitarianism is to him unthinkable because he appreciates that truth so well expressed by the poet Blake, "One law for the lion and the ox is oppression." I therefore can see nothing to keep him from joining hands with the libertarian who arrives at the same position by a different route, perhaps, but out of the same impulse to condemn arbitrary power. And that concludes the essay, but just a last thing for me on this. Weaver is spot on there. As long as conservatives and libertarians both will condemn arbitrary power in all of its forms, so no more giving corporations a pass just because they're the biggest bullies on the block. No more of that. We have to condemn arbitrary power in all of its forms. These huge consolidations of power in the private sector are just as dangerous as the government. The only official difference right now is that a corporation does not have the power of the military or the power to compel you to shop with them. But the more that these entities fuse, the more that corporations can do backdoor things for the government that the government is officially not allowed to do because of the Constitution that libertarians are increasingly coming to say is a worthless scrap of paper. So let's keep that in mind. Thank you all again for your time and for tuning in. Again, I hate to be a beggar, but just to reiterate, we are at the end of the year. If you're looking for anywhere to dump a little bit of spare cash, please consider throwing it my way. I have a Cash App profile for the show. If y'all are more comfortable doing a one-time contribution, I can understand not wanting to do a subscription. So thank you again for your time, and I will talk to y'all next week.
Little Miss Jeffersonian has made her triumphant arrival, and I can tell you that raising a newborn is expensive, so if y'all don't mind contributing to our diaper fund, I would greatly appreciate that. And don't forget to help fuel the Jeffersonian Revolution by using the link in the show notes page to purchase your go-backs today. And all right, with another episode in the books, thank you again for tuning in, and I will talk to y'all next time.